Warning, this episode contains brain food that will lead to improved emotional and social intelligence. Thanks for tuning in to Harvesting Happiness today for a healthy serving of consciously prepared brain food. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen, your host. For more than 13 years, I've been handcrafting these sound ideas for better well-being. Each week, I love spotlighting diverse thinkers and doers who are contemporary trendsetters and change agents, devoting their lives to creating a better world in which to live. I invite you to listen up and change the way you think about human happiness. Our award-winning content is fresh, optimistic, and purpose-driven media that promotes well-being from the inside out. Alrighty then, let's dive in. This episode offers psychosocial education designed to inspire and motivate our listeners. The information provided does not constitute a therapeutic relationship nor a substitute for professional mental health care. If you are experiencing a mental health crisis, call 911, go to your nearest emergency room, or for listeners in the United States, text 988 for the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This episode was recorded in the chaos of construction. And if you do hear any pounding noises in the background, it's because my garage is being built. I waited 5 years for this baby, so I couldn't postpone it. Anyway, enjoy the show. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. Thanks for joining me on today's show, where you will learn about timeless wisdom, the secrets of longevity, elderhood, and the good life. My guest today is Ben Myers, who is the founder of LongevaQuest, LQ, a research company focused on the world's oldest people. LongevaQuest works with super centenarians, people aged 110 and above, who have wisdom to share far beyond their secrets to longevity. Ben, welcome. I am so excited to have this conversation with you.
I'm excited to be here. Nice to be with you, Lisa. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about LongevaQuest, why you started it, and what you do over there.
So I started LongevaQuest because these people who we research are really fascinating. And as you stated, it is beyond just their longevity themselves. They are really fascinating individually. Their histories are great. And in the past, it was really nonprofit organizations and volunteers who were in charge of certifying the world's oldest people, but there's a lot of work involved in that. And that part is not even so scientific. You're looking at somebody's age over time, birth certificates, et cetera. It takes some time. And so we realized there's a lot of demand for this information. And there were really only 10 or 11 so-called super centenarians validated at any one time. And so we ended up starting to do it as a business and hiring folks to do it full time who were previously doing it as volunteers, providing resources. And now, instead of 11, we know of 277 alive today. And going back and looking in the past, there were many others in the past who were super centenarians who weren't recognized during their lifetime. But we really feel there's a whole lot to learn, again, not just about longevity, and looking at them as a story of not just lifespan, but health span, because they lived to 115 sometimes, and almost sometimes until that age, they're living such high quality lives. And there's really so much that we can learn from them. And we're learning more and more every day from things they have to teach us.
So what goes into certifying someone as one of the world's oldest people? You talked about that originally volunteers did it, then you hired people to do it. And I would imagine there's a lot of administration that goes into this.
A lot of it. And it's very rare for somebody to just emerge and suddenly be recognized as the oldest person in the world. Usually if somebody's, let's just say 115, they might've been in the paper when they were 100 years old, when they turned 105, when they turned 106. It usually makes some news. And so usually there's somebody that we know about for a while. And let's use, for example, the oldest person in the world today, Senora Maria Brenes Moreira, outside of Barcelona, about 2 hours away. At one point, she was the oldest person in Catalonia. At one point, the oldest person in Spain. And then eventually became the oldest person in the world about 15 months ago. And so they are known. They tend to be a little bit famous beforehand. And really, it comes down to making sure that they are the age claim. There's some reasons why over time, somebody's age might be uncertain. A lot of it has to do with the fact that records that weren't always amazing at certain parts. But usually by the time they're 110, we're able to say, hey, this person is definitely among the oldest people in the world. And then they essentially over time through their longevity rise and eventually obtain that title. And so a lot of the work is done before they become the oldest person in the world.
Tell me, how old is the oldest person on record ever?
Ever was 122 years old.
Wow. Talk a little bit about their history.
So her name was Jean Calment. She was a woman who lived in France who actually met Vincent van Gogh when she was very young, who came into her father's shop. But she was born 1875 and lived till 1997. What's very interesting about her lifespan is that nobody has since come too close. The second oldest was 119 years old. So there are some scientists, mathematicians who are looking at her age and saying, wow, that is an anomaly. We're really not so sure. But to be frank, the records are extremely clear that she was the age that she was claiming. And you know, she is an anomaly in other ways as well. She was I don't want to give any listeners the wrong message here. She was a chain smoker until a very old age. When she was about 85, there was a 55-year-old neighbor who wanted to buy her place. And there was some agreement where basically he was going to pay to her some sum for basically as long as she was living, and then he would get her place at a discount. Well, she ended up outliving him by 10 years, ended up making a fortune. She was just a very interesting woman and was not somebody who you would look at characteristics-wise behavior as being very good for longevity. But then again, she was a chain smoker, but was riding a bike until she was 110. So just an extraordinary person whose age has since not really come close to being matched.
Let me ask a couple of questions about life choices in addition to lifestyle. So this 122-year-old woman, was she married? I think people are probably wondering yes, about that.
Yes, but was widowed much longer than she was married.
Aha. Did she have kids?
Yes.
Okay. Because I had a sort of a cheeky theory. Maybe she was never married and she never had kids. But
there are some who are like that. Yeah. And there are theories. It's amazing because if you ask a super centenarian who was married with kids, you know, why they've lived so long, you know, my marriage and my children. If you ask somebody who didn't have it, you know, why have you lived so long staying single? You know, everybody's secret is whatever's worked for them.
Well, that's interesting because it speaks to attitude, right? Which is something that your research is highly correlated with longevity, right? It's not just genetics, not just the DNA, but the attitude that person possesses about life and their circumstances.
Absolutely. There's, of course, a genetic component, and we see that because there are exceedingly few, if any, supercentenarians who ever pass away or even develop things like cancer. I mean, there is a genetic component, which is being researched as well. But the universal trait, I'd say the most common trait, is an optimism. And one thing that we've noticed, and there are some others who do surveys of folks who are a lot younger. We study folks who are 110 and up, but where there's a lot of folks, I'm almost 34, younger than me, who don't really aspire to live to 100. You know, health is advancing, medicine's advancing, and there's a lot of depression about the state of the world. But these people who are 110 years old today, when they were in their 20s and 30s, the Great Depression, it was a worldwide phenomenon. It was World War II, worldwide phenomenon. A lot of societal metrics, literacy, child mortality, were very far behind. And a lot of them had very challenging lives. You could look at a lot of their histories. It was amazing what they've had to go through, but they've maintained a real fortitude and they've looked for things that bring them joy. And I would say that there's a focus on their lives and their families and not such a global focus that you could really find anything to be depressed about, but they try to focus on things to be happy about. And it's tough to quantify somebody as an optimist or a pessimist, but it's probably a universal qualitative characteristic that we've noticed across almost everybody who lives to that age.
In going to LongevaQuest's website, there are wonderful stories there. I think that's one of the neat things about the website. You can go and you can look at these stories of people from all over the world that have lived through trials and tribulations. I don't think that people are minimizing the storytellers, you know, or the perspective of these elders. They're not minimizing the fact that life is hard or difficult, but what they're celebrating is the things that are going right, which when you look at the science of happiness or positive psychology and what it studies, right, are the attributes of people who self-report their own well-being, their own life satisfaction based upon their own experiences, right? It's not telling people how to be happy. It's saying that these are the things that make us happy.
Right. And, you know, it might not be that anybody has to mimic their hobbies, but it is their approach that I think is very admirable. And we are talking about self-reported, but that means a great deal. And there's a lot reported about mind over matter, and there are scientific examples of that. And when they say I'm happy, there is a physiological element to that. And we see a lot of folks, and they have, when somebody's lived 110 years, they have a century of memories to choose from. They could tell us sad ones, they could tell us happy ones. And they talk to us about impactful moments in your life. They tend to talk about happy ones. And there is a power to that, and there is a conscious decision. I wouldn't call it suppression, because it's well recognized. They have a deceased husband, you know, who's been deceased for 70 years. His picture is still on the wall every day. There's no suppression. There's just a selection to focus on the good.
Yeah. Oh, I like what you're mentioning. It's not the minimization of the bad things that have happened, but it's the celebration of the good things, or the things that are good right now.
Right. Right. And even in the past, we had a very meaningful visit. This was in January, a lady named Hanako Ishii in about 90 minutes outside of Tokyo, who is blind, has some day-to-day challenges, but who whose face was just lit up. I mean, just full of life, vibrant, talking about when she was 8 years old, having a picnic under a tree with her mother. And so we're talking about something 102 years ago, and it's like it happened yesterday. And there is undoubtedly, and you can see it, when you're observing the person talking about this, that there is a physiological benefit to it.
Well, that recalling a positive memory and emotion is a positive psychology intervention. You know, it's particularly helpful for people who are depressed, who are going through a period of depression, to recall those things, because it makes us feel good, right? It releases pleasurable hormones in the brain that make us feel better. That's not an accident.
Yes. And people can choose. It's like the opposite of rumination. It's basically when somebody says, go to your happy place, their happy place is like right there.
Yeah.
But you did mention as well that it's what makes them happy currently. And you have folks who are 110, and they might have been in a center, in a residential home, possibly sometimes for 25 years. And yes, they have family visit, but they also get to know the people there very well. And, they have the joy in their routine. So it really is noticeable. And we've seen it manifest in people where, there are some concepts that are perhaps cultural, and we view them one way in the West, one way in the East. But we're talking about, people in Japan and Latin America, and the United States and Europe, who are all talking about a similar way of viewing life.
What made you personally interested in this subject? What is your draw to this? Because you're a young man, and, it's not something that young people would normally want to study.
Mm-hmm. It actually started when I was much younger, actually. I was a history buff, and I was very curious if there were, this is around 2006, 2007, if there were any veterans still alive from World War I. At the time. And there were maybe 10 of them at the time. And they were all about this age. And I was thinking, wow, it's very interesting how people live this long, it's being tracked. And I really couldn't find a lot of information about it online. So I started what a lot of people did in the 2000s, started an internet forum called the 110 Club. And sure enough, there was not, as I had mentioned earlier, there was not too much infrastructure or support to this field. And so that ended up for about 15 years being the main place online where this information was stored and discussed and kept. And I would say, aside from just the history information, I was lucky to know six of my great grandparents, a lot of whom lived in Gainesville, where I am right now. And I'm still close to my grandmother, lives down the street. It was close to all my grandparents. So there is a joy in dealing with folks like this. And when we go and visit the super centenarians, they are, our grandmother that day, they are our grandfather, we're their grandkids. They're very special visits. But I think there's a mix of factors, but getting involved early on and having that community develop on something I started, quite a while ago, made it easy to take it the next level.
It's fascinating. And kudos to you, because I think the world needs to know more about these people, so, and what we can learn from them. I want to talk a little bit more about the notable characteristics. You talked a little bit about their perception, genetics playing a certain role in this. Is there anything else that we could at least start talking about, and then we can continue when we come back?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, of course, what we talked about are major factors. And then when we look at, aside from that, are other biographical factors. And so one thing we see a lot is that there is a predisposition away from big cities. There is an element where, and the concept of a suburb is not as common elsewhere as it is in the United States. And so we see rural areas are more well represented. One thing that's very interesting, and we compare their statistics sometimes to, you know, versus 110 and up versus the general population, or 110 and up versus 85 and up, let's say, or 80 and up, whatever it's being cited. So if you look at, for example, alcohol drinkers, just drinking any type, whether it's a glass of wine a day or whether it's a lot more than that or whatever, if you look at super centenarians versus the average population, they're less alcohol drinkers than super centenarians. But compared to 80 and up, there are more. For smokers in their life, there are more. So it's an odd effect where there obviously are some other factors involved in that. Beyond that, we are noticing it is folks who are largely live near their family. It's very, very rare for somebody to live past the age of 110 with no close family member. And very frequently, it involves grandkids. There's a generation gap. And, you know, folks live past children who might be in their 80s or 90s.
Think about that for a second. I would love our listeners just to like think about that thought for a minute, right? That these super centenarians have kids or grandkids in their 80s and 90s.
I'll give a great example. Ms. Elizabeth Francis is the oldest person in the United States, lives in Houston, lives with her daughter who's 94. The other primary caregiver is her granddaughter who is almost 70, you never know. And at one point there were, I believe, five or six generations in a photo there, and they all, she lives at home and they all come to her. But it's when you look at a 114 year old mother and 94 year old daughter living in a household together, it's incredible. And they just, you know, take it day by day, but it's been a constant in their lives for so long, it seems, and it's a really beautiful thing.
But I want to hit on the intergenerational or multi-generational home, which is something that is foreign to a lot of Americans.
Yes.
But not to people from other countries, right? 100%. This sense of community and social connection and belonging and continuity of care. Having done it myself, because we took care of a family elder who lived well into her 90s, it's an important thing.
It's very important. And that's a very astute observation about it being international, because if you look at a place like Japan, and Japan is nowadays associated with aging and the concept of demographic trends, but really people do live a very long time there. And a lot of it has to do with the respect they get within their families, multi-generational housing. And some folks, you look at it, you know, in our culture, it's more aging as a decline. In Japan, they seem to view aging as an ascent. You know, if you look in, you're not put to the corner. You know, you're put at the head of the table. You are more respected over time. And that multi-generational housing keeps them in each other's lives. And it also reduces the amount of, I hate to use this term, but the amount of burden or stress involved in being active on the part of the younger generations. If visiting grandma means an hour drive each way on a weekend day, that's something that a child is not always going to like. But if visiting grandma is, hey, grandma's here every day living in the house with us, they can't help but get a close relationship. It's just, you know, they're just part of their lives.
Yeah.
And it leads to much closer lifelong relationships.
Love this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we are going to continue the conversation with my guest today, Ben Myers, to learn more about the work at LongevaQuest or LQ. Please go to longevaquest.com on X. That is at LongevaQuest. Here comes the pause. I'll be right back. Hang on just a second. Before we pause, I want to remind everyone how much stress impacts our lives. And sometimes the day-to-day craziness even impacts our bodies. Think breakouts, bloat, and thinning hairlines. Just like our skin, the condition of our hair reflects our overall health, and there are internal factors that can affect the way our hair looks, feels, and grows. And that's why I use and love Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding. Your hair is never just about your hair, and Nutrafol knows that. That's why Nutrafol takes a whole body approach to hair health, addressing the problems inside to help hair grow on the outside, supporting your lifestyle, not just your hairstyle. Nutrafol has five formulas for different lifestyles, including plant-based diets that are tailored to what your hair needs to grow and achieve visible results in 3 to 6 months. Each physician-formulated product is drug-free and made with high-quality ingredients that are clinically tested to multi-target the key root causes of thinning, including stress, nutrition, and lifestyle. I've been using Nutrafol religiously for nearly 2 years. My hair is thicker and healthier because of Nutrafol, and remarkable side benefits include better sleep, improved stress response, and a significant reduction in those pesky menopause symptoms, including hot flashes. No matter your lifestyle or stage of life, Nutrafol is a great solution that targets the root causes of thinning and supports hair growth from within. Simplify your self-care with easy online purchasing, no prescriptions or doctor's visits required, free shipping and automated deliveries ensure you'll never miss a day. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code HARVESTING. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code HARVESTING. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code HARVESTING. Here comes that pause. We'll be right back. Each day, we have the intellectual freedom to be happy or the liberty to be miserable, regardless of external circumstance. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, seek support, because good psychological health is vital in the achievement of a happy and satisfying life. Visit harvestinghappiness.com for psychosocial educational resources to boost emotional and social intelligence. Like what you hear on Harvesting Happiness? Sharing is caring. Pay it forward by spreading the word to your community and through social media. Subscribe, listen, and share hundreds of downloadable episodes from wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with and follow us on most social media channels. And we're back, continuing the conversation with my guest today, Ben Myers. We're talking about timeless wisdom, the secrets of longevity, elderhood, and the good life. Let's get back to it. So, Ben, in the prior segment, we talked about some of the attributes of these super centenarians. I want to go back to something that you said that stuck in my mind. When you were a kid and you were interested in these World War I veterans,
yes,
and there was about 10 of them that you had found, I would love for you to talk a little bit about what you learned from them and resiliency and the ability to bounce back after adversity.
I will give you a very specific answer to that, because there's one person who probably personifies it more than anybody, and that's a man named Henry Allingham, who was one of the last living British veterans, who attributed his longevity to, I'm not saying I took this literally, but he said, cigarettes, whiskey, and wild women is what he said. And he said that when he was 110. And what he really meant, without, again, it's not so much the hobbies that people have, that's what you would say. It's more about he was a naval veteran, but many of the World War I veterans were in the trenches. And it was, yeah. I mean, you know, there's obviously terrible things occurring around the world still, but that was perhaps as bad as it ever got for anybody. There was obviously a terrible death tolls, and you know, it was a terrible situation. And he, with that comment, embodied, seems to be the attitude from a lot of British and French and even German veterans. Because with the United States, we were not, I say we, you know, obviously, you know, we weren't around, but our country was not too involved in World War I towards near the end. But for the British and French and Germans, you know, they call it the Great War for a reason. And with what, you know, Mr. Allingham said was basically, hey, they came back and they wanted to just basically focus on the present, focus on living life. He came back. They were still young people, very young right. people. And they said, well, instead of spending it in the trenches, they wanted to have a normal youth. And it may seem a little crass the way that he said it, but I think philosophically, bouncing back and pivoting from a very traumatic experience to going and enjoying, quote unquote, the good life for what at that point would have
pleasures
been maybe a 22-year-old. Let's just say the cigarettes and whiskey. Let's leave out the last part. But just, you know, basically enjoying a fun, youthful experience yeah. after what he had, I think is a good example of bouncing back.
When you spoke to some of these veterans, what did they say about their lives and their relationships moving forward?
I wish I had spoken to some of them. I was never able to meet a World War I veteran. That was sadly well before LongevaQuest. I wish I was able to. Some others have said so, super centenarians, but and I have spoken to World War II veterans, but I was never able to meet a World War I veteran, sadly. The last one passed away in 2012.
Well, so let's go to World War II then. You know, maybe the U.S. engagement was not as great. The losses were not as great, but nonetheless, the service of these men and women was huge. And there were the spoils of war, the invisible wounds of war, the visible wounds of war. And what do those folks report about their lives that lived into their hundreds?
Well, it's interesting because I've actually talked to folks on both sides of that. And I, you know, it's been long enough now, of course, that it's not, there's no ill will, but I'll give you an example from the Japanese perspective of World War II. So a lady, Shitsui Hakuishi, who is the world's oldest living barber, she's 107. She actually did my year in January, but one of the most traumatic events in her life was that she didn't know what happened to her husband. She just didn't know. He was missing for a long time. He was in Japanese forces. It was missing for a long time. And then a few years later, you know, she had to raise a kid. She had to be, you know, run a business. A few years later, an officer came and confirmed the worst. And it wasn't as if he was missing for a few years. It wasn't as if there wasn't a reasonable hope of finding them. That it happened frequently that they came back. But in this case, she got very bad news. And it was clearly, I mean, it, to this day, it impacts her. But the words that she used and that a lot of others used were a variation of, I had no choice. What choice did I have? She was a young woman. She had a business. She had two sons. She had no choice but to go forward. And so it was kind of like we talked about in that first segment, where the picture of her husband is still there. It's not that he's wiped from her memory, but there's a lot of folks who, it wasn't a conscious decision. Okay, I could ruminate in grief. I could be held up in trauma, or I could move forward with it. It was basically, I really don't have a choice but to move forward. They're kind of one foot in front of the other approach. From the United States, there was a little bit less of that, I think probably because there was such a triumphant atmosphere afterwards. And with Japan, though they rebuilt quickly, there were several years where it was a really not good situation there. But it seems like that folks just really didn't have a thought to let themselves be impacted by it for too long of a period of time.
What is resonating for me as you describe these stories as them not whitewashing their trauma, right? No one is trying to erase what happened, but to create some sense of a good life because of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think we learn from that. We should be learning from that.
We should, because I think there is sometimes, and I'm now speaking a little bit outside of my realm of expertise. This is much more yours, Lisa, but there is sometimes a temptation, I think, for folks to say, well, I can't forget about that. I can't do this. And you know, keeping a negative attitude almost as a homage to something that you don't want to forget. And these folks have learned one way or another to go past that. And there are, you know, many theories as to what social media and what all that has done to somebody's psychology. But, you know, these folks of this generation seem to have a very healthy attitude about it.
We are nearly out of time, and I want to make sure that we do a proper recap of this, because I want listeners to know that we've got some amazing teachers out there in the world. There are how many? 200 and how many?
277 validated right now, and there are probably some more.
Yeah, that have a wealth of wisdom to impart to us about living the good life. And I would love for you to recap some of those major points.
Sure. So across the world, there are supersensitarians, and throughout their different cultures, the main constant between them is attitude. And you have folks who lived and grew up and came of age in very difficult times, but they still had an optimism that lasted this day. And we see it in both ways manifest today, where somebody who's 110 years old can speak and be lifted and have stress reduction. We're talking about something that happened with her mother over a century ago. Or on the other hand, you have people who just find joy in their day-to-day lives right now, whether it's with family, whether it's with caregivers. We haven't talked too much about the sandwich generation. We should talk about that a tiny bit, because
yes, we should.
It's almost a very odd manifestation of it here, because when you have, we did talk about the children in their 90s and 80s, and when you have children of that age, sometimes it's difficult for them to provide care. And so you know, we talk about that, those five generations I had mentioned, and that you might have somebody who is a sandwich with two on each side. I mean, my goodness. And it, you know, there's a situation where somebody is, their caregivers might not live their caregivers. And that may happen more and more as people live longer and over time, people have less children. there's more of a need for care, of course, and you know, less of a source of caregivers. And so there's going to be a real, you know, something that's going to happen as a trend is already happening in Japan, where AI is taking a lot of the burden from caregivers in the administrative standpoint.
Really? And explain a little bit more about that.
In the very early stages, but where AI is really doing a lot. So in Japan, not only do people live a long time there, but there has been demographic trends for a while related to a shrinking population. And so we're looking at that. And a lot of people are familiar with robotics in Japan, where people have seen primitive androids that can go. And I think robotics are pretty far from being able to delicately assist an elderly person without harming them,
right,
to avoid them from falling. I think we're far from that. But you may know it yourself, and you know from your experience, Lisa, and we look here at how much administration is involved in caregiving, and there's the requesting refills from doctors, and there's the caregiver, you know, you were supposed to supply the live-in nurse or the nurse being in there for 3 hours today, they weren't there. Oh well, Medicare denied it. I mean, there's so much administration waiting on hold. You know, hold for me, AI is going to be a huge thing, I believe, for elderly people because it actually exists right now, or for caregivers, because think about as a professional having to spend so much time out of your day to arrange care for somebody. And then that's time that you're spending caregiving, but not with that person.
Yes.
Not with them physically.
Yes. Giving them what they really need, which is your attention.
Right. And of course, it's Maslow's hierarchy. They really need a roof over their head too. But that's something that only you can provide is that physical attention and that physical, being with them, watching the show with them, doing a game with them, something like that. And so as we look ahead towards the sandwich generation, I think that AI is going to be huge for those in that. And just so everybody knows what was sandwich generation, those who have care on both sides, if it's young adults or children, then it's elderly, if it's parents, grandparents. Think about how much time you spend on every task of caregiving, and AI is poised to take a lot of that away. And so I think help is on the way with that, and it's going to free people up to do what only people can do, and that is take care of somebody.
I love that you said that about doing what only people can do, because so many people are frightened of AI. And from my perspective, I'm not frightened of it. I think it's really interesting and useful. And in fact, it's only as good as the human behind it, right? Because it doesn't operate without human input, actually.
Right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. But it's something that could save so much time. And you also think about when we think about instances of, we haven't seen AI help in this instant yet, or at least I don't know of an example, but of elder abuse, of having to engage, the cost involved in engaging an attorney of an elder's being mistreated. And, ChatGPT, and not to be basic, but let's say it's free and can do an 80% job of an attorney for 0% of the cost. And now suddenly you can have a demand letter written if there's an elder abuse situation. It allows people to be better caregivers, because the things involved beyond the physical care are really going to be aided and just a matter of time. I'm not saying that ChatGPT can compose a better letter than you or anybody, but they could do a B minus B plus job somewhere in there.
And then you tart it up
in an instant.
or bring it to an attorney and let the attorney polish it, but you're paying for less time with the attorney.
Right.
So that's where the economy of scales come in.
Yes. And then you also have more time to actually take care of your loved one. And that's going to be a big help because the sandwich generation, that means by default, you're in your career. You have the experience, the ability more than anybody to deal with these problems. And so it all falls on the settings of caregiving are in the United States, it's 25, 60 hours a week. They're neither of those numbers are very uncommon. That's a full-time job.
Yeah.
This is going to make it less of a job. And maybe one day it'll be easier for people to see caregiving not as a burden, but as a privilege, kind of like they do in Japan. It's, hey, I get to go and take her out to lunch or play her favorite game with her or something like that, instead of having to do tasks.
To enjoy the relational activities, which is what actually creates the happiness, for us humans. Well, the caregiving sandwich is real, and that's probably going to be a whole other show that we're going to need to do, because you hit on something. When somebody is good at the administration stuff, when you're right in the middle of your career, you're still parenting, you've got these elders that their health is failing, it's the one that has the most skill is tagged as the one that takes care of all of that stuff. So the burden and the burnout or that caregiver who's caught in the middle is real. And you were talking about that there are conferences that people go to for that. And I think that's really interesting. And we probably need to talk about that, because the longer we live, the more of us are going to be in this position.
100%. And you know, it's something that the demographics are not good, because when we look at non-family caregivers, there's fewer and fewer people around. People are, you know, the population trends are not amazing. So we're going to have to figure out how to use AI and how, you know, we're going to use that to free up our time to make sure that we're taking care of our loved ones and doing right by them and doing all that we can to make sure that they don't feel forgotten.
And so we don't have a reverse trend, right? Where the mortality rate goes down because of the stress levels going up and the burnout levels going up. So that's a whole other part of a different conversation.
Anybody who's listening to this, I would try to avoid thinking about it so big picture. Just think about what you could do in your own life and just say, hey, I mean, you have an older adult who is somebody that you should care for. Focus on caring for them. And if everybody does it in their own lives, then the macro problem solves itself. I think this is an example of what we talked about earlier, where if somebody focuses on the macro, it could seem too daunting. Just focus on, you know, your parents, your grandparents, your loved ones, and do your part there. And you'll be really doing a whole lot for the entire world by doing that.
One final question, and that is our longevity statistics rising? We know people are living longer because of medicine, but is it rising exponentially in terms of, no, that's what I thought.
Not exponentially. It is a trend. There was a slight decrease with COVID. You know, there is a trend overall. But one thing that's interesting, we were talking about Jean Calment. She was 122. She passed away in 1997. Nobody has since come within 3 years of her. And so the maximum, we call ourselves the authority on maximum human longevity, the maximum longevity has not gone up. Now, overall longevity goes up. And we talk about life expectancy, that's top and bottom. And so as child mortality goes down, life expectancy goes up. But, you know, people are living longer overall, but it is not exponential. And there's been no real increase in the cap. But that is one reason why, as we discover and get to know more living supercentenarians, we also look at people in the past, because we don't want somebody in 20 years from now to, you know, look around this time period and see what we did and see that suddenly there were a lot more people who were 110 and up. What happened in 2022 that suddenly there are so many 110-year-olds than there were before? So we obviously are going back to make sure that we know throughout history. And sure enough, it turns out it was a lot more common for people who were in the 1830s to reach the age of 110 than we knew before. And so I would say that the trends are going up, but not in a huge way. And we still haven't figured out how to puncture that maximum of 122 years.
Ben Myers from LongevaQuest, thank you for joining me today. This has been such a fantastic conversation. Definitely food for thought and inspiring. To learn more, please visit LongevaQuest.com. Once again, that's LongevaQuest.com. You can also connect with Ben Myers on X at LongevaQuest. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us on Harvesting Happiness. This is Lisa Cypress-Kamen on behalf of my guest, Ben Myers, wishing you kind thoughts, kinder words, and the kindest of actions. Until next time, remember, happiness is an inside job. Happiness is your inside job. Please go out and rock your day, and remember to be kind to one another. Want to take a deeper dive into sound ideas for better well-being? Check out our new bonus edition content, More Mental Fitness by Harvesting Happiness, available exclusively on Medium and Substack. Keep harvesting your own happiness anytime, anywhere, from the comfort of wherever you are. Subscribe, listen, and share hundreds of downloadable episodes from wherever you get your podcasts. Connect with and follow us on most social media channels. To learn more about lifestyle management and mental fitness consulting services, please visit harvestinghappiness.com. Harvesting Happiness and More Mental Fitness are produced by me, Lisa Cypress-Kamen, Andrea Mengele, Robin Boyd, Andrea Daly, and the awesome team at Podfly Productions, including Eric Begay, Kimberly Beck, and Alec Guess, in collaboration with TogiNet Radio, KBUU, RadioMalibu.net, and is available on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.